WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You know how life can go along day after day with its little ups and downs until suddenly something happens, something tragic, that changes your life forever. It's how these events can unravel the life of a family that interests novelist Rosellen Brown. She's the author of Civil Wars and Tender Mercies. Her new novel, Before and After, describes life in one family before and after the 17-year-old son is accused of murdering his girlfriend. This is a middle-class family in New Hampshire, not used to violence or scandal. The mother is a pediatrician. The father is a sculptor. The murder shocks them into the realization that they no longer know their son. I asked Rosellen Brown to read a section from this new novel after the father finds out his son is probably guilty and the murdered girl was pregnant.
I would have had trouble saying what I thought, that whether he did it or whether miraculously he didn't, I had lost faith in knowing anything. How could it matter what I believed? I couldn't imagine what his head was full of. His memories now were his own. Well, they always had been, of course, only it wasn't so visible. And his motives, too. You start out thinking your child's life is in your hand. You can hold it all right there. He's with you all the time, that little baby. If he plays with friends, you're there. You referee the squabbles. Carolyn and I took turns. If anything, I took some of her turns. You buy the toys. You close him in the yard where he'll be safe. And you think you know the whole cast of characters in his head, the scary parts and the sweet dreams. Only one night he has a nightmare. It rips his sleep in two, and yours as well. You rush in, pull him from his crib as if it's on fire, and comfort him against your shoulder, and he can't tell you a thing. Or a word or two he gives you, a hint, a clue to where the monster came from. Oh, that terrible movie, as if you need Walt Disney to make nightmares. It's huge and hairy, and it was right behind him. Or he fell from a cliff onto the rocks below. Whatever. Where did he get that from? He doesn't watch violence on the tube. He's never had a trauma. Spontaneous combustion is what it is. The little microbes grow in the warmth of his head, that moist medium. Then he matures a little out of eyeshot, down at the daycare where he has experiences you never hear about, little ones too insignificant to report. Ginny pushed him off the swing. Seth gave him his cupcake at lunch. Good, bad, invisible, all of it. The arrogance, the chutzpah. It's his life, even if it's small and hedged by adult watchers. It's his life. But it's a long way from that to knocking up a woman, and a long way, I realized with a shock that was almost electric in its violence, between the young father I was and the grandfather he'd have made me. Would have, could have, except for death intervening. It rolled over me like a sheet pulled up over my face.
I'm wondering if during the course of writing this or before you wrote it, you ever thought about what your two daughters were capable of and if you ever imagined one of them doing anything as extreme as, you know, the murder that's in the book.
Well, not really. They're a couple of pretty nonviolent kids. On the other hand, of course, the book opened me up to the terrible possibilities that anything could happen in any family. And that was what was is a little scary about it for me, and I think for my readers, that, of course, the book posits a very ordinary family, and, you know, like my own. And so it's exactly someone like me who thinks, no, my kids are pretty nonviolent, who could, of course, receive a blow like this, because I'm you know, trying to put forth the idea that almost anything can happen in almost any family. There were, in this family, of course, some trouble spots that possibly these parents might have known about. But I think it's gotten very hard for parents sometimes to be able to read what's normal in their children and what's not. And I think I can understand why these people didn't really quite comprehend that their son might be, you know, headed for some kind of problems.
You tend to use real tragedy, real catastrophe, to get at the existential family tragedies that you want to, you know, ultimately write about. Why do you look at real catastrophe? What
draws
you to that?
I think I sort of, in some ways, I guess I kind of use it as a jump start to my imagination. But the reason that I think I do it is that I'm not really all that, this might surprise you, I'm not really all that interested in the actions, in the events, and you never see them directly in my books. They always seem to take place off stage before things start. In Tender Mercies, a woman is accidentally injured in a boating accident that her husband has inadvertently caused, although what inadvertent means is complicated because his actions arise out of his character. At the end of the autobiography of my mother, a child perishes, I think is the word for it, partly because of the character of her grandmother or a kind of a problem between her grandmother and her mother. And in Civil Wars, which is about a lot of things, post-civil rights novel, really, but one of the things that sort of makes the action go in that book is that two children are orphaned and come to live with, these are two little segregationist children who've grown up in a very bigoted household, come to live with their aunt and uncle who are ex-civil rights workers. And there, too, there's a terrible event that brings them to live with this family. But none of that ever, and in this case, of course, there's the murder. None of this ever takes place on stage. What I'm interested in is the aftermath. I'm interested in how people act after tremendous cataclysms take place in their lives. What happens when ordinary people have to respond to the unexpected? And that simply fascinates me, but the events themselves don't. And so I think that I like to start these books rolling with something large and then watch the very, very tiny increments in which people, you know, which people kind of have to deal with as they go. They're not really plotted books in a sense. They're books that work
more by character.
Yeah, right. And the character works by sort of building up the what ifs. You know, well, what if your son were accused of murder? What would you have to do? First, you would have to deal with, you know, the neighbors calling, and then you would have to deal with the police, and then you would have to deal with, you know, your work. And I kind of, the same thing after Laura is injured in Tender Mercies. What if this happened then? They're really if and then books. I think that's what I'd say.
One of the very big what ifs that you deal with in Before and After is, okay, what if your son was accused of murder?
Right.
And what if you found incriminating evidence? Would you try to destroy that evidence? Would you cover up to save your son? Or would you tell the truth? And
right, that's
a really difficult what if, the kind you could probably only answer if you were in that situation.
I think so. And I think each situation, of course, would differ. I should tell you that what brought me to this book was a case that took place in Houston quite a few years ago, and the particular details of the crime didn't interest me. I don't read crime books, and I'm not particularly compelled by any of that. But what fascinated me was that in this situation, a boy was accused of murder, and his parents refused to testify against him to bring their evidence to the grand jury. They ended up in jail while he was out on bail. And I was compelled by this because I discovered the reason that they were in jail was that although spouses are protected most of the time from having to testify against each other in court, parents are not. They don't have that privilege. If you have evidence that might incriminate your child and you're called upon to give it, you have to give it. And so in this book, one of these parents goes to jail. The other one chooses a different road and tries to tell the truth.
So in this book, you've kind of made both decisions. I'm sure you've thought about, although it's really impossible
to
say.
I haven't. I've hoped that people would sort of duke it out about which one they, you know, which one they wanted to go along with.
Well, do you know which one you would have chosen? Though I know you can't say because it's the kind of thing you can only say if you're in this situation.
Yes, I think that's right. No, I really don't. You know, I tried so hard to be even-handed in my thinking and in constructing these characters that I really am not even sure in the end. I think it's in some ways probably best for a novelist, I think anyway, for the kind of novels that I want to write, not to have a clear opinion, because if I did, I would probably shade things one way or another, you know, toward the point of view of one character. I really tried terribly hard to get myself inside the heads of each of these parents as they tried to figure out what was the best way to react. And of course, they are very different in their natural constitutions. Ben, the father, is very impulsive and very, very strong-willed. And Carolyn is a pediatrician and has devoted her life to taking care of children and to trying to ease their pain, and is tormented by the question of what she owes to, in a sense, to children, to the dead child, and to the parents of the dead child. So, you know, as they worry out their points of view, each of them really, one of the reasons I can't say what I would do is that each of them works out of his or her own character and personality.
Your new novel is called Before and After, and it's before and after the murder, before and after the incident that basically threatens to end the family as they know it. And it's really not your first novel that's a before and after kind of novel. There are other novels in which lives are kind of divided by this catastrophe. I have to say, I kind of live in fear that my life will end up a before and after life, and somehow in the after part, I'll look at the things that made me miserable in the before part, and they'll look like the golden days by comparison.
Oh, I think that's true. I was just reading an essay yesterday with a class that I was teaching. I'm teaching a class in essay writing in Houston, and we were reading an essay by Nancy Mayers, who's a very good writer, and she was talking about, it's an essay about having adventures, and she talks about how she's redefined an adventure since she's discovered that she has multiple sclerosis. And for her now, an adventure is something very tiny, and it's sufficient. And we spent a lot of time in class talking about whether it should have to take something catastrophic like MS, you know, to bring you to the point where you value small aspects of your life. But I think we all worry about that.
Really, why do you worry about that?
Oh, I believe in the evil eye looking at me. You know, I think I'm probably very primitive in my thinking. I have a feeling that I write these books in which horrors take place. They're not horror books, but horrible things happen. I really do believe that deep down, I want to placate some force that I couldn't even name by saying, look, I've already imagined this, so please don't let it happen to me. You know, I've already worked through all of the terrible details, and now maybe I will be exempt from having this kind of thing happen.
Were your parents preoccupied with catastrophe? Was this a big subject at the dinner table?
No, absolutely not. No, a very ordinary, truly an ordinary family. We've never even broken a bone in our, you know, collective collective body of the family. I just have an imagination, I guess, that works overtime on what could happen. People talk very often about whether we're grateful or not for our ordinary lives, and I think I actually am one of those people who wakes up every day kind of grateful, you know, to be awake another day. I do think about it a lot. I'm based on nothing in particular. It's just that I look around. I once, when I lived in New Hampshire, which is where this book is set, I once did a little survey on a road near me, up the road a little piece, a bit. I just went around the block asking myself what I knew about the people who lived in all those houses. And although I'm not a very negative person, I think I have a fairly buoyant personality nonetheless, what I fixed on was that for every one of those houses, I could think of something that was really, you know, a kind of awful fate working itself out. Some of the people would come through, I suppose. This isn't to say that I'm, you know, I don't believe in affirmation, but there was one house in which the father had been arrested for drunken driving, another house in which a terrible cancer was eating up the mother in the household. The third house actually contained two children who had come to this family after an automobile accident. Not coincidentally the way it happened in Civil Wars, because I got the idea from looking at them. Another house in which, well, here was a happy one, actually. An adoption had taken place after many, many years of the families not being able to have their own child, but that was fraught with great pain, even though things ended up wonderfully. So as I went along the road, I was aware of the fact that every household hides some kind of drama, if not tragedy. Doesn't have to be tragic.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Rose Allen Brown. Her new novel is called Before and After. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Rose Allen Brown. I'm wondering what your family was like when you were growing up. Where did you live? What did your parents do?
Well, we moved around a lot in my childhood, and I think this has been a really major factor in my life and in my writing. We moved for no particular reason. Everybody tries to help me out by saying, were you a military brat or something like that? But in fact, it was just coincidental. For example, I started out in your town. I was born in Philadelphia. And people often say, oh, I thought I heard a little Philadelphia accent there. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we moved when I was 10 weeks old. at the end of 10 years that my parents lived there, they were New Yorkers, and they moved there for a job. After that, there were just a succession of moves that, you know, just were the sort of coincidences of my father's work. He was involved in selling textiles and being, you know, nothing particularly exciting in that. But we moved around a lot, and we even, we went from Philadelphia to a couple of Pennsylvania towns, and then to the major part of my childhood I tend to think of as having been lived in, up in Westchester, sort of working class Mount Vernon, New York. 4 or 5 years. And then we moved to Los Angeles for a year, which was a profound uprooting for me. And then we moved back because that was kind of a failure. We weren't a feckless family. It sounds as if we were. But these were just sort of boring coincidences. But I started writing when we lived in Los Angeles because I found myself in a new school with no friends. And that was the year that I started carrying a little secretarial notebook to school with me and writing stories about girls who woke up on their birthday to find the perfect horse grazing in the yard, you know, the kind of thing that nine-year-old girls are fascinated by, the beautiful horse with a star on its forehead. If I didn't have any other friends yet, I did make them eventually, but I didn't at first, then I could at least be friends with myself by writing in my notebook.
So you were always moving around and not belonging.
Yeah, exactly. And I've tried to write that out. I have only one book in which someone is of the place. I have a book of poems that's a sort of a narrative. It's 84 poems, but they really tell one story in the voice of a New Hampshire woman who is still living in the town that she was born in. And she tries, in fact, to get away. Of course, she's going the other direction. And I wrote that book to see what it would feel like to actually be moored to a place and not be sort of free-floating. But everything else has been an attempt, I think, to write about, you know, what it's like always to feel slightly alienated, really like an outsider.
In the mid-1960s, you spent, during the Civil Rights Movement, you spent a few years in Mississippi teaching, I believe, at Tougaloo College.
That's right.
College. Yes. And this is an experience you drew on for your novel, Civil Wars. How did you end up there?
Well, it was interesting. I was a Woodrow Wilson fellow in college, in graduate school. A girl could be a fellow. Woodrow Wilson at that point, this was mid-60s, decided that they wanted to send some of their old fellows to what they called emerging colleges, which were mostly black and mostly poor. And, you know, we were supposed to sort of go and beef up the curriculum, which had some interesting assumptions built into it, I'd say. But there was plenty of work to be done, of course. And so we wanted very much to take, my husband and I wanted to take part in the civil rights movement in some way, but to be frank, we were really cowardly, and couldn't quite imagine ourselves out on the front lines. That changed fairly quickly when we got there, because the college that we ended up at, Tougaloo, was a real sort of civil rights haven and was much despised in the community around Jackson, Mississippi. In fact, it was often referred to as Cancer College because it had always been open to civil rights activists and so on, and a lot of the students demonstrated, and we were, in fact, right in the middle of a lot of things when we got there. We taught there for a couple of years, and then my husband went to work for one of the first Head Start programs in the country as the anti-poverty program geared up. And, of course, we discovered that you couldn't stay outside, you know, on the sidelines, and we really didn't want to. In fact, we went there having promised our parents that we wouldn't even ride in what was called a mixed car at the time, with blacks and whites together. And 20 minutes on the campus, someone asked if we would drive into Jackson to go to a play. I think they were playing in White America, ironically. And of course we said, sure, pile in. And that was the end of that vow, that cowardly vow. So we were very much a part of things for those years. But of course there too, you realize that was not our movement. I think, you know, whites, of course, were terribly significant in the civil rights movement, but it was not ours. And so it wasn't a place that you went to seeking home.
What did you feel that you most had to contribute to the civil rights movement while you were there and a part of it?
Well, I personally, after my teaching was over, I was writing about it. And I have, f- fought with myself and wrestled over the years. This is really one of my major obsessions. The question that writers like Grace Paley are always asking themselves, how can I be most useful as an activist or as a writer, as a recorder, you know, as a kind of historian of all of this? And in the end, I chose the less active path. I'm not very good at it, and I have decided, and maybe I'm too narcissistic for it, I don't know, I've decided that my place probably would be better filled, writing about what I've seen. And I remember being very, very honored when Robert Coles did a review of my first book of poems, Some Deaths in the Delta, and said that poems are events, too, and that having caught some of the feel of black and white Mississippi on paper was equally valid and that it served its purpose. And I guess I'm always searching for purpose. And I've worried a lot about whether writing was taking the easy way out, but that's what I did.
As somebody who writes about families and about the most complex and conflicting emotions within families, what do you make of the politicization?
One of the things that I hate, Terry, is the simplification of so many complex questions. Aside from, you know, who uses this for what purpose, I really am very, very put off by the idea that this can be used as a moment for flag waving and to make this incendiary and to divide people, when in fact we know that family values are just incredibly complex. And what do we mean by that anyway? So, you know, inevitably, all my books have been devoted to trying to show how complicated our lives are. At one point, Judith, the 12-year-old, she's about 15 at this point, near the end of the book, talks about the word irony. She's learned how it has to do with holding two ideas in your head at the same time, you know. And I think that that devotion to complexity is one that's gone all through my work. In Civil Wars, a little boy, an 8-year-old boy, has to discover that he can like someone that he's supposed to hate for political reasons, and yet personally he thinks she's quite wonderful. And all he can do is, he actually throws up, since he's a little kid and can't express this in any other way, in his confusion, because he doesn't know how to deal with the complexity of his real life. And I think that's the reason that I hate the invocation of family values, which just bleeds out all the grays and makes everything black and white again.
Well, Rose Ellen Brown, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Rose Ellen Brown's new novel is Before and After. We recorded our interview in September when the book was published. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.